All I know up to now, this is a keeps evolving from one day to the next, this problem. Well, thank you, David, and it's a great honor to be invited to give an ITP colloquium. This is a fun topic in some ways. It is about a toy that actually comes from very near here. The inventor or the developer of the toy is a man called Joseph Bendick, who lives in San Diego. And I didn't know that when I wrote my piece about Euler's disk, as it's called. Is that... I shouldn't walk up and down, should I? Is that the... Does it matter? I have made contact with him since I arrived here. In fact, he's visiting Santa Barbara next week, and I hope to have discussion with him then about various aspects of this toy. I'll show you right away. I mean, many of you, I think, know it already. You can purchase this from the Tangent Toy Company in Sausalito, so as I say, it's not far from here. So what interests me about it, in fact, the title of the talk that I proposed to David was the title of my little paper in Nature. It was published about a month ago. The title of that paper was Euler's Disk, that is this, and its finite time singularity. But David said, oh, that's too technical. And so he suggested the alternative form of title that you have seen, which includes the words theory and experiment. The experiment will now begin. So the experiment simply consists in taking this disk. It's a fairly heavy disk, weighs 400 grams. It's solid steel with chrome plated. And it actually has a thing stuck on the surface, which is just for optical effect. But I leave it there. It makes it look prettier. And you set this into a gentle rotation, very gentle rotation. And it is actually like the principle of a spinning coin. If you spin a coin on a table, then you know that after a while it goes unstable in its spinning about the vertical, and it goes into a final stage before it settles on the table. And during that final stage, which for a coin lasts for only a few seconds, there's a sort of shudder in which the angular velocity or the frequency of the shudder appears to increase before the whole thing comes to a very sudden stop. Well, now, it turns out that the heavier the disk, the more massive the disk, the longer this process goes on. I suppose our ancestors back in the Middle Ages, when coins were really coins, they were heavy and worth having in your pocket, they probably were very familiar with this sort of phenomenon. Although, in fact, it only works if the coin is very smooth, and a property of coins is usually that they're not smooth, they're rough. In our country, they have the Queen's head on one side and something else on the other side. You see, this has been going, and I'll do it a second time, this was just a rehearsal, but it's been going for about a minute and a half. And this is the stage at which the it speeds up. I think I can use this to amplify the sound. It's a very sudden stop, the final crunch comes. In fact, now, I'll tell you the whole story of this, the actual publication. Nature have a wonderful press release sort of process. They always issue a press release a few days before the publication each week. And in this case, the press got onto this particular one. It's a brief communication, a one-page thing in Nature on the 20th of April. And I knew something was up on the 19th of April when the phone started going in. Press agencies from all over the place wanted to talk to me about this thing and said, here, you've solved the problem of the spinning penny. I thought, oh dear. And anyway, I talked to them, and I found myself the next morning at about 7:30 in the morning on the Radio 4 program in England. It's called Today. It's a program that is very widely listened to. I listen to it every morning myself. I wake up to it. So there I was talking to John Humphrey on the radio. That was just the beginning of a very long, hard day. it attracted attention from all over the place. And finally, it actually made the science page of the New York Times. I think I have one of my. Well, I can show you all of it. I mean, the actual paper was just as simple as that. One page with a little bit of mathematics. I think it was the fact that there was so little mathematics in it that, of course, attracted the attention of the media. They thought, oh, well, this is something we can cope with. And it went on to a BBC news page and was flitting across everyone's computer the next morning. And then the Daily Telegraph in England got onto it. And the journalists, of course, like to sort of play on words that they can... get. The Physics Web put it out. Each one of these things involved about a one-hour conversation with the journalist who was trying to understand the thing. And then the most impressive of all, actually, and I am very impressed, I'll say, with the New York Times, this was just a few days later, they got onto it, and that was the result of a long conversation, but the science correspondent on New York Times really did make an effort to understand the scientific issues involved. Well, what are these scientific issues? I will just run it once more, and you might like to time it, because this is rather important, but not yet. I'll tell you when to start. The thing is, we'll start off when the angle between the disk and the plate is about 5 degrees, that is when to start timing it. Well, that's probably about now. It doesn't much matter. If you could, if you have a watch with a second hand, we'll give an estimate. And I will hold the disk towards the end. There's something else that can be done. I will show you. No, I think I have to do that a little later. We'll just let it run. Now, the point is the angle, I call the angle alpha between the disk and the horizontal plate. The disk is actually rolling on its rim. And you can see, for one reason or another, that the center of the disk is hardly moving. This little vibration, you see, is because of the precession. So there is a little frequency there, and that frequency is increasing, and you can hear it increasing as the note just gradually rises. as the angle decreases, the angular velocity of precession increases. The disk itself is actually rotating very slowly, and there's good reason for that. Now listen to this again. That's amplifying it particularly well, but you can see that the feature is this, that the note rises and then whoop, it stops very suddenly. Can we explain that mathematically? It is actually a finite time singularity, and in a sense, this angular velocity of precession goes to infinity at a finite time. That is the nature of this singularity. Of course, as I said in the paper, nature abhors singularities. It just won't allow it to happen. So something actually must resolve the singularity at the very end, and I think that is the nature of the little thump that you hear. Something, some physical process resolves the singularity, and I can describe just what that is. I had a load of transparencies in England on this, but I had no idea that I would be invited to lecture on the subject here, so I didn't bring them with me. And I didn't want to write them out again. So I thought I would use the blackboard instead. And because the mathematics is fairly simple, I think I can work it out on the blackboard. It is, in a sense, the sort of problem that... first, I will describe the problem as Euler in 1765, the year that he published his great book on the rotation of rigid bodies. the way that Euler would have addressed this problem. This is the disk if we look at it sideways on, and I'll turn off the projector for a moment. If you have a disk and it rolls in general on a plane, it's a rather nasty problem. It's a non-holonomic system, and one can write down the non-linear equations for this system. You'll find them, for example, in the large treatise on analytical dynamics by Pars, one of the most systematic and thorough treatments of analytical dynamics. But I don't think it's possible to solve these nonlinear equations for the rolling of a disk analytically. However, observation suggests that it does settle down, and this is the reason for this is not known, and it's an interesting problem in itself. But it settles down to a situation in which the point of rolling contact, which I'll call P, we'll call this the point O, the point P moves in a circle on the plane, and insofar as dissipation can be neglected, and Euler would have neglected dissipation, the point O remains fixed. The center of mass remains fixed, and the point P simply moves in a circle. So the whole thing is precessing with an angular velocity, call it omega, about the vertical, and that is what we observe. Now, in fact, of course, dissipation can't be neglected, and this is the crucial part of this problem. Dissipation causes this angle alpha, for one reason or another, to vary slowly with time, to decrease slowly and finally to zero. And in fact, at that last stage, rather abruptly to zero. That's what we want to understand. And there is a relationship between omega and alpha, which was probably found by Euler for this problem, on this assumption of neglecting dissipation. If you neglect dissipation, there is a solution in which that disk will roll forever with constant angular velocity and constant angle alpha, and the relationship between these two is omega squared sine alpha equals 4g over a, where a is the radius of the disk, and g, of course, is gravity. And it becomes obvious from that formula if by some mechanism alpha should go to zero, and we know it must go to zero, alpha goes to zero, it implies that omega must go to infinity. Like, sorry? Why is it constant? I will explain. Yes, it will be an adiabatic invariant. I'll treat it as an AD. But what I'm saying for the moment is that this relationship is found for the steady solution with no dissipation. We will then admit that alpha varies slowly, and I'll make the adiabatic assumption that that it's quasi-steady, as it were, and that this omega squared sine alpha remains constant. So it's omega squared alpha when alpha is small that is going to remain constant. Well, you see the potential interest of this. Of course, the interest really is to, one should identify the dominant source of dissipation for this problem, and then somehow model that dissipation and incorporate it in the Euler-type analysis, perhaps using this as an adiabatic invariant, this thing constant, in order to finally get a differential equation for alpha as a function of time, which will explain everything. Yes. I will do it in terms of energy. The energy, as it turns out, for this Euler problem, the energy is just proportional to alpha, the angle alpha. Well, you see that for the potential energy, but also the kinetic energy is proportional to alpha. So that's where, if we get a rate of change of energy, so what we have to get is the dissipation of energy, rate of dissipation of energy as a function of alpha. Now that means, we have to identify the dominant mechanism of dissipation of energy. And there are several. For example, you've got a point force going in a fairly rapid circle on the plane, and that is causing the whole projector to vibrate a little bit, and the table to vibrate, and energy is lost in these vibrations. That sort of rate of loss of energy and mechanism of energy dissipation is extremely hard, however, to quantify. Yeah? No, it doesn't. It doesn't. No. That is exact. It's actually sine alpha, but alpha when alpha is small, it's alpha. It's on the assumption of rolling and precessing. I'll work it out. There's the vibration loss of energy, and it's just hard to quantify that. Depends on the geometry of this whole system, so imagine what a horrible problem that is. There is also a problem, and it's something that I don't know anything about, of rolling friction. When one body rolls on another, from the classical point of view, the point of contact is instantaneously at rest, of course on the table, but also in the disc. It's instantaneously at rest. And therefore, no work is done by the tangential force at the point of contact. If no work is done, it means there's no loss of energy associated with rolling. But real life isn't like that. There's a small deformation of the surface underneath, the glass in this case, and possibly a small deformation even of the steel. And there's also a phenomenon known as microslip. And the net result of these processes, and also perhaps little elastic waves that go off in the medium underneath, that there's another loss of energy. But again, extremely hard to quantify. I don't know if it can be. Perhaps there are experts here in rolling problems of rolling friction who can tell me. I will try to estimate this a little later. But the third mechanism of dissipation, and it's the one that I understand, and therefore the one that I focused on, is simply to do with the air, the surrounding air. And you wouldn't think, I mean, there's viscosity in that air, which is very small. Air is a pretty inviscid fluid in this sort of context. and so you'd think the dissipation due to air friction is very small. However, when the angle alpha becomes very small, so we're very near the plane, this layer of air becomes very thin. And the air in one, as that omega, you see, as you move from that position to the opposite position, the air that was here has to move across here. So that gives you a rather rapid movement of the air. And actually, what is happening is that, say, this is the disk is not really, the point of contact is rolling, but really every point of the disk is just moving up and down. This point here is just moving up and down with an increasing frequency. So the air under it is having to move from there to there and has a no-slip condition because it is a viscous fluid on both the plane and on the disc. That means there's a very strong shear in the air, and that is the way that this energy can be dissipated. So I thought it would be interesting to work out on the basis of lubrication theory, there's a well-established theory for flow in thin layers, work out the rate of dissipation of energy due to air friction. Maybe small, but at least we know what the viscosity of air is, because we don't know what the coefficient that governs the loss of energy for one body rolling on another. That is not known. So we take something that we know. We know the viscosity of air. Let's work out the corresponding contribution to the rate of dissipation of energy. So that was the strategy. Well, first I have to. all right.
I think you can justify your approach by saying that at a very small angle, all the other mechanisms.
Yes, I agree with you. I'm very glad to have your support on that point. I think that is true. As alpha goes to zero in the final stages, it is the air viscosity that does dominate over all the others. Of course, you need two very smooth surfaces and that sort of thing. But these are pretty smooth. This is good. I cleaned it. It's smooth. And now we have to just look at this problem. Firstly, how Euler did it, and I hope I can reproduce the sort of argument.
Experimentally, is there a significant difference in behavior on
typical? Yes, there is. Oh, yes. Yes. Terrible. Yes. Even if you put a rug on this table and this onto the rug, it makes a difference. It absorbs some of the energy. Yes, if you, David Harris, who is here and is in the chemistry department, has also been interested in this toy for a number of years, I believe, and is now doing an experiment, or his student is doing an experiment in your colleague. Right, in a bell jar, evacuated the air out just to, in order to. The problem is to get your hand inside the bell jar. But the problem has been solved. all of these issues come up as soon as you start thinking about this problem. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? Obviously. And I think there are many, many interesting aspects. but anyway, how do you do this? Obviously, somehow you've got to use Euler's equation for angular momentum, dH by dt, in a fixed frame of reference, which is the rate of change in a rotating frame plus omega cross h, where this is the rotation of the frame, and that is equal to the gravitational torque. And this is really why this is called Euler's disk, because the whole thing depends on somehow solving that equation. I said rotating frame. You see, you can think this point is rotating angular velocity omega. If you move into that rotating frame, then it's as if the disk is brought to rest and the table is rotating backwards under the disk with angular velocity minus omega, and the geometry is then at rest. And in that situation, the disk is in a fixed position, but it can be rotating about its, in that same fixed position, about its normal. And it, in fact, is rotating about its normal. And I'll call that omega d, disk, the disk rotation in the rotating frame of reference. And that disk rotation is related to this precessional angular velocity by the rolling condition, the fact that from either point of view, the velocity of that point in P is the same on the table or in the disk. And that consideration, in other words, the rolling condition, tells you that omega d, the omega d times a, is equal to omega times this distance, omega times a cos alpha, where we cancel off the a. Omega d equals omega times cos alpha. And moreover, when we go back to the fixed frame, what is happening? In the fixed frame of reference, where the table or the projector is at rest in this room, this point is instantaneously at rest, also in the disk, because the disk is rolling. This point is at rest, and therefore, instantaneously, the motion of this disk is one of rotation about the line PO. Instantaneously. Of course, so instantaneously, it's angular velocity omega. That's all you have, rotation of the disk with angular velocity omega, and it's a magnitude times a unit vector in the direction PO. So that way, E. That's the instantaneous motion. But of course, that E is a function of time because the disk is precessing. So the direction is changing. So that's instantaneous. And the angular momentum is moment of inertia, omega E of t, where that moment of inertia is the moment of inertia of the disk about the diameter. So 1/4 ma squared, where m is the mass of the disk, A, its radius. That's the angular momentum. And what is that angular velocity? Well, it was omega d in the rotating frame, And we go back to the fixed frame, it becomes omega d minus omega. And omega d is omega cos alpha. Cos alpha in the direction which I could call E disk. You see, this is the sort of problem that you really, that you try to teach undergraduates, and that they hate you forever because it's just so. And minus the omega, which is in the z direction. So minus omega Ez. That's the actual angular velocity of the disk instantaneously. And what we're really interested in is its magnitude, omega. So we dot with the direct, we know it's in that direction, E. E dot Ed is zero, and E dot Ez is sine alpha. So you have a relationship also between this rotation, which is how you start it off. To start this disk off, you hold it at an angle, and you just give it a little rotation about that diameter, and it starts, sets it rotating. So, you've got omega equals minus capital omega sine alpha, and here's the angular momentum. So now we can write down the consequences of Euler's equation, dH by d. Yes, I have. I've neglected, and you could obviously improve this, take account of the thickness. Yes, I've assumed it's very thin. And that will modify the expressions, but not the principle. That's right. Now, in the rotating frame, it's steady, so this is zero in the rotating frame, the frame I've chosen. So all we're left with is omega cross H. So omega is capital omega times Ez cross. I use that notation because I'm attached to it. It's very unconventional nowadays for the vector product. But I use it because Maxwell used it. And it, what's good enough for Maxwell? <good enough. laughs> Ez cross H. Well, H is A. We've got it here. So there's going to be an A, omega, and there's E. Ez. So let's take it all out. There's an E cross and an A, and the omega is in there. And that omega, remember, is omega sine alpha, equals gravitational torque. That's just mg down here. So it's crossed with this vector distance A, E cross mg, Ez sort of thing. So it's there's another AMG, and I think it's with a minus. It's E cross EZ in this case. And the nice thing is, of course, that E cross EZ is the same on both sides. The direction, fortunately, is compatible, and we've now got a relationship. Now, omega, that omega is omega sine alpha. So here's where you get the omega squared sine alpha on the left equals a constant on the right. That A is a quarter MA squared, so we bring it over here. The M goes out and leaves us with 4G over A. So that is this result. And that is, well, I've hunted through the book of Euler. I can't actually find a treatment of this problem, but I assume that Joe Bendick called this Euler's disk in deference to Euler, who understood, obviously, the principles of this sort of calculation and the fundamental equation that governs the dynamics. The theory that gives this sort of thing is in the book of Alan Parr's, where this formula is available. And because Euler did it around then, it's just the sort of problem that can be taught, and usually is taught, to students of applied mathematics. But it's at the limit of comprehensibility, usually at second year level, say. Well, so that's all we need to take from this. Omega squared sine alpha, 4G over A. And then we say, now, sine alpha equals 4G over A. Now, that is neglecting dissipation. And according to Euler, that will continue forever. Omega constant, alpha constant, and it's obviously nonsense. For any disk and any conditions, it will come to rest. And it's because there is always some weak dissipation. Well, the dissipation, as I say, let's consider the air dissipation. And I freely admit that there are other mechanisms of dissipation, but this is the one we can calculate. So let's calculate it and then consider the others. So we're in the situation. Actually, there is an equation known as as Reynolds' equation in lubrication theory, which should allow one to calculate the pressure field in the gap and then to calculate the additional torque due to the pressure acting on the disc. But that Reynolds' equation for this geometry and this precessing situation is rather nasty, and I haven't been able to solve it analytically. So that is what drove me to consider the more approximate method based on energy arguments. I should have said that the energy, remember the kinetic energy of the disk, well, it's a half A omega squared, and that's a half, and we've got the quarter MA squared, and this was capital omega squared sine squared alpha. So we take omega squared sine alpha is 4G over A, and that just leaves a sine alpha. And so this cancels, and an A goes, and you're left with a half MGA sine alpha for the kinetic energy. The potential energy is MGA sine alpha. Potential energy, MGA sine alpha, because it's just the height of the center of mass above the table. So it's an interesting situation. The kinetic energy is always one-half the potential energy, and the total energy, sum of the two, is three-halves. MGA sine alpha. Sine alpha, and it's that is gradually being dissipated. So approximately, when alpha is small, three-halves MGA alpha. Oh, by the way, did you time the experiment? 75 seconds. All right. Yes. Well, there's the energy. Now, the dissipation is what we need, because the rate of change of energy is minus the rate of dissipation of energy, and we call that phi in fluid mechanics. Well, in a time 2 pi over omega, this air moves from here to here. Actually, in time pi over omega, moves from here to here. So that gives us an estimate for the horizontal velocity in the air. It's of order of magnitude. It's of order of magnitude. Well, in that time, it moves a distance of order A. So it must be A pi. Is that, have I got it the right way around? That's time. A divided by pi over omega. So of order A omega over pi for the horizontal velocity, order of magnitude. Let's do it in terms of simple order of magnitude for the moment. It's good enough. And that's the horizontal velocity. As I say, that you have no slip at top and bottom, and therefore the gradient, vertical gradient of that horizontal velocity, we get by just dividing by this scale, which is A times alpha, when alpha is small. So du horizontal by dz is of order A omega over pi, and we put an extra A alpha on the bottom. So that horizontal shear, and that's actually the vorticity in the fluid layer, is of order omega over pi alpha. You can keep the pi or you can throw it out depending on how. I mean, one can improve. There's always going to be constants of order unity that we can't quite pin down, but we want to get just the dimensional character correct. So that's the shear. Remember now that alpha is going to zero and omega is going to infinity. So this is going to very much going to infinity, the vorticity in the layer. Certainly the dissipation is going to, well, the volume of air in which this is happening is going to zero. So we got to work it out. Phi, rate of dissipation of energy. You would normally calculate that as the integral. You take the viscosity times this velocity gradient squared and integrate with an r dr d theta d dz over the whole layer. It's the volume of air. And, of course, there's air everywhere. But I'm just, the dominant contribution to dissipation is certainly coming from this region. So we need just take that volume of air. The rest really is negligible. Well, order of magnitude. We take our square of this thing, so omega squared over alpha squared. I will forget about the pi. It's not going to matter too much. Times the volume of the layer. Well, there'll be a pi. That would have canceled the pi anyway. A squared times the measure of the height again, an alpha A. An alpha A. So one of the alphas goes. This is mu A cubed. And we've got omega squared over alpha. Well, again, omega squared alpha, remember, was 4g over A. That's the adiabatic assumption. Let's suppose that that continues to hold. Everything's changing very slowly. So the omega squared, 4g over A. So mu A cubed, 4g over A. And we've got an extra 1 over alpha, so 1 over alpha squared. 4 is neither here nor there. A squared. Mu A squared g over alpha squared. Well, alpha is going to zero, so the dissipation certainly goes to infinity, although the volume in which this air is dissipating is going to zero. So it's got some curious features to this problem, obviously. And but now we can immediately feed that into the equation for rate of change of energy. The energy was 3/2 mgA, and we're taking rate of change, so d alpha by dt, and it's equal to minus this thing. Now, there's a constant of order unity, and mu a squared g over alpha squared. There's our equation. And, well, anyone at high school level can integrate an equation of that kind. It's alpha squared d alpha by dt is like d by dt of alpha cubed. Alpha cubed is equal to minus a constant. I think I'll call that constant. I'll call it 2 pi over t1, where the t1 happens to be m. Well, see, there's m. There's a mu there. It's actually m over mu a. That is something with the dimensions of time. Better have the mass of the disk divided by the viscosity of air times the radius of the disk. It's a time, which we can obviously calculate for this disk. That's the equation, and therefore we integrate and get alpha cubed equals 2 pi over t1. And I'll write a constant of integration here, t0 minus t. And therefore alpha goes to 0 like a cube root as t tends to t0. So alpha is the 2 pi over t1 to the 1/2. And then it's t0 minus t to the 1/3. On this mechanism of dissipation. Yes, it is interesting. It's very interesting. And that it doesn't depend on gravity. It depends on, it's driven, this is a process that's somehow driven by the viscosity. I don't think you can have G zero, that's right. If G is zero, then it's sort of, you don't, this sort of equation, you see, the G is cancelled, but you wouldn't have had an equation in the first place. So G must be non-zero, but the answer is independent of G. Now, the funny thing is that it is, there's a sort of battle going on here. In the Euler zero dissipation situation, you've got gravity somehow being balanced by inertia associated with the angular momentum equation. So a little dissipation allows gravity slowly to win over inertia. And so this is very like the big crunch. Or it's like star formation, gravitational collapse, resisted by angular momentum, so you get a disk. You can break that sort of severe angular momentum constraint if you introduce some dissipation, some viscosity or something. So in some ways this is a nice model of some of these much more complex processes. But anyway, the alpha goes to zero like T0 minus T to the 1/3 now. So there is that behavior. There's T0, here's T, and here's alpha. Of course, the corresponding omega, remember omega was alpha to the minus a half from this thing being constant. So omega then goes to infinity, according to this theory, like T0 minus T to the minus 1/6. So here's our finite time singularity. Well, now, there's things can go wrong. Firstly, in order to assume, make this adiabatic approximation, that will break down. Adiabatic approximation. It's okay, provided alpha dot, the rate of change of the angle, which is constant in Euler's theory, provided that's small enough. And I think it means that provided that is small compared with omega. Omega is this precession frequency, and if alpha dot is varying slowly, then an adiabatic approximation should be okay. Right? You look quite. And that, of course, is going to break down. Because, well, it's pretty good. Alpha's going to infinity, but, I mean, omega's going to infinity, but so is alpha dot. Alpha dot. Alpha dot less than omega. Do you think it should be omega alpha?
Alpha dot over alpha.
That's a point. Yes, I suppose that could be right. Yeah, I thought that this would do, but you may be right that alpha dot over alpha. I'm just not sure what would be the appropriate. Alpha dot over alpha less than omega. Okay, well, I've used the wrong one. Okay. However, they both break down. However, something else breaks down, and I believe it breaks down before this adiabatic approximation breaks down. I should really leave that picture here. we've got alpha there, so we can work out alpha dot, and we can work out alpha double dot. And alpha double dot, acceleration of the angle, according to this, is our 2 pi over T1 to the half. We had 1/3. Should that be 1/3? Thank you. A third. So differentiate twice, and there'll be a third, a third, and another 2/3. And then a T0 minus T to the minus 5/3. I say this has nothing to do with turbulence. So the downward acceleration apparently goes to infinity. Now that's troublesome because the absolute forces, we've got mg acting here and we've got a reaction acting here. And the downward acceleration cannot exceed g. because that would imply a negative reaction at the point of support. And obviously rolling would cease. Either it would slip or it would lose contact and we'd move into some other phase. So in fact, breakdown occurs when A alpha double dot is of the same order as G. And that will happen because this is going to infinity. And so I worked out the value from that, very easy to do. And the value, if we call it time tau, just before this T0, just before T0, we'll call it tau, at which somehow this singularity breaks down and is resolved. We call that tau. Tau is given by, well, by equating these two things. And here I will just, because I'm sure to make a mistake in the calculation, just give you the answer as it works out. I've take it from the transparency. The tau comes out to be equal to 2a. Now, this does depend on g, over 9g to the power 3/5. This is coming from this sort of thing. When you times 2 pi over t1 to the power 1/5. Well, we know T1 here. On T0, well, it, because it is T0 minus, the tau is T0 minus the T, it's that combination. Okay, it's this little bit here. The time before the singularity that would occur. Well, we now have to work out the values of these things. There's a T1 for this disk. Of course, it depends on the disk you have, depends on the size of the penny. But for this disk, the T1 comes out to be zero, quite large, 0.8 times 10 to the 6 seconds. That's essentially...
Are we supposed to take the 2
pi
and the 2 nines
now
seriously?
Yes, I agree. Now, I've been very slapdash in the way I've done it. I've neglected constants. But I tried in this calculation to keep the constants of order unity when they were worth keeping, when it was sensible to keep them. But still, there's an uncertainty in the final answer in that constant. So it's really true only in order of magnitude. I would say that within a factor plus or minus 20%, maybe 50%, factor 1.5 that you've lost in all this estimate wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, if I do the problem with the much easier problem of a disk settling onto a plane through a viscous fluid, if I do that by the energy method, I get it right, but losing a factor 1.5. So that is the sort of uncertainty in using the energy method. But this is a large time anyway, 10 to the 6 seconds, remarkably large. It's the sort of a Stokes damping time. If you had a pendulum and you use Stokes' law for the damping, it's the long time that it would take to damp out the motion. And on the other hand, well, T0, you see, there's our alpha. And T0 is, how do we determine it? Well, we have to determine that from the initial condition. At time T equals 0, that's when you started your watch. Let us suppose that alpha is alpha 0. You start it when the angle is about 5 degrees. Well, you have to estimate 1 radian. then the T0 is determined as alpha 0 cubed over 2 pi times T1. And if I take alpha 0 equal to, I think I did that here, alpha 0 equal to 0.1 of a radian, in other words, about 5 degrees, then, so we take 0.1 cubed here, small angle, and get the T0, then the T0 is about 100 seconds. Ah. 100 seconds to the stopping time, where you hit was 75 seconds. That's within our margin of error. Now, what can one conclude, you see, from this? It's just that the viscosity of air, which you might think at the outset is not going to be anything at all relevant, is actually sufficient to give you the right order of magnitude for the stopping time.
What is tau?
Now, tau, okay, we work it out from this formula. Now, g is very large in this context. It's about 1,000 in CGS units. And we've got the A, and we've got the 2 pi over T1, and T1 is quite large on the bottom here, you see, although it's the power 1/5. Well, that turns out to be about 1/100th of a second. This is really rather remarkable, that for a problem like this with a disk that is a sort of human scale, you have these two timescales. You get 100 seconds on the one hand from this form. Of course, it's because it depends on viscosity of air. And on the other, the stopping, when the model breaks down, 1/100th of a second before the final stopping time, which is very small. Now, using my adiabatic, maybe I've got the wrong criterion there. I used when does the adiabatic approximation break down, as opposed to this loss of zero reaction condition here. The adiabatic approximation is much shorter than this, another three orders of magnitude smaller. So actually, when we get to the point where it either starts to slip or lose contact, the adiabatic approximation is still valid. 500 hertz at this instant. Yes. Yes. Now, I'll show you I have a colleague in Hong Kong who is also immediately, when I told him about this, got to work. So the frequency of the point of rolling contact, that omega, 500 hertz. It's not very high, but that's as near to the singularity as you can get with this disk. Now, these are measurements taken in Hong Kong by Vladimirov, who has the necessary electronic apparatus and whatnot to measure various things. And the angle, let me see. Let's see what he's got here. These are rotations. This is actually the angle. Angle to horizontal, alpha, in degrees. And he starts at between 4 and 5 degrees here. And he must have this time scale. His time it's times 100. Times 100 or something. Yes, it is. But you see this curve here, t to the 1/3. He's gone in here, which comes in rather nicely and matches in this final stage. Yes, out further out, when the angle is larger, the exponent is larger. It is t to the 0.4 out here, or even, I mean, this curve, which is his best match, I think, is t to the power 0.446. So significantly larger than 1/3. And that is what makes one think that perhaps there's some other mechanism. No, it isn't. The rolling friction is the other possible mechanism. And you might think that this dissipation term, all we need is to know what it is as a function of alpha, and then we can integrate the equation. The dissipation term I don't know. It's probably some constant. It's probably proportional to the mass. This is the rolling friction, the mass of the disk. Because the heavier the disk, the more it deforms the surface. And so you think proportional to the mass. And probably on dimensional grounds, it must be proportional to the mass. And what? Perhaps omega, the rate of movement of this mass point is a possibility, but of course it might be omega squared, I don't know. But if it's omega, omega is proportional to 1 over root alpha. And then you've got an equation. if that is the dominant mechanism of dissipation, then d alpha by dt is proportional to 1 over the square root of alpha. That's not such a bad singularity here, and it gives an alpha that is going like, again, a t0 minus t, still a finite time singularity, but it's 2/3 instead of 1/3. So it's not stable, the 1/3. It depends very much on this function phi as a function of alpha. And the fact that it's greater than 1/3 but less than 2/3 suggests that both of the mechanisms are important. It's finding some kind of compromise, but it actually approaches the 1/3 as alpha goes to zero when the air viscosity takes over. They all come, well, yeah. Of course, what it needs, what he should have done, this is very, very recent. This is a log-log plot, slope. And the log-log plot, I'm sure, reveals these different slopes. Well, that is roughly where we are now. David Harris, I know, has got made progress, you see, with the no air at all. You haven't. But it's just ready to go. Yeah. I think what you told me was that in these preliminary runs, where in the vacuum, it runs longer. You remove one source of dissipation and you expect the thing to run longer. So to that extent, anyway, that indicates that air is having some effect. But you didn't believe it to begin, but now you believe it, you see. You see? So it does it. I've tried that, and it stops very quickly. Yeah. I just thought, if I have another do I have 5 minutes, or is it, do I, it used? Yeah, because if I set it rolling? You'd like to see it again? Yeah, well, I'll set that rolling once again here just to remind you what it is we're talking about. And you listen to the note while I... And this is a finite time singularity, you see, before your eyes. On a reasonable human time scale of 1.5 minutes, you don't have to wait 10 billion years for this one. But the time singularity of a collapsing universe presumably satisfies a similar sort of equation. It's an algebraic singularity. Oh, no, that's another good point. Yes, of course. This is there are all sorts of aspects of that kind. I calculated the rate of emission of the rate of radiation of energy due to sound waves from this thing, because again, you've got an oscillating source and a sound field, and you can estimate that. My conclusion was that that was definitely an order of magnitude less than the viscous dissipation in the air. But of course, when you get to this. I don't know. That's another consideration. Yes. It's still subsonic. It's still, but the, yes. It's. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's still pretty incompressible. Yeah. No, that is essentially what is. It is a quasi profile in the lubrication theory, and that is the correct estimate that I gave for the vertical shear. I mean, if you were to try and improve on this and calculate the constants of order unity, you need to solve that Reynolds equation, which is based on quasi flow in the gap. It is a quasi flow everywhere, locally. And that's where this estimate for the shear comes from. I thought you might like to see this, and since I, again, with the help of David Harris, his kind assistant, I got 2 glass plates from the chemistry laboratory this morning, and it's only fair to show a situation that does not involve a finite time singularity, just by way of contrast. And this... It's just a very, yes. Oh, it's the glasses, yeah. That's the problem. Now, this is honey. This is viscous liquid. Viscous liquid. And you just need a little bit of it. And you place one glass plate, they're quite solid plate glass, on top of the other. And this is a problem that, you see the similarity between this disc problem. I mean, there's a layer of air in the disc that is being squeezed out. And we place this second rather heavy plate on top of the first. Then it is the honey that is squeezed. And Newton could have solved this problem. The two plates are parallel. And the radius, you see the radius of the circle? It's perfectly circular, which is very remarkable. As good a circle, if you can see it, as Titian could have. I think if we can turn out the lights, then I will show this better. Can we? Perhaps still not all that clear, but you can see the boundary, very circular. Now, the interesting experiment you can do with this, of course, when I say this is not by no means a finite time singularity, that the radius continues to increase slowly with time, and it actually goes like the 1/8th power of time, the radius. The thickness, the gap between the plates goes to zero algebraically, like t to the minus 1/4. So smoothly to zero. So to be contrasted with this situation where it goes woomph, this one goes slowly to zero. And this is an irreversible phenomenon, because if I slip a knife between the plates and then... quite difficult. They're already too close. Yeah, there. Okay, I'm between the plates now. But watch the boundary. You see that? That, I think, is the best demonstration you can get of Safman-Taylor fingering. And then a sudden phase change. You see? It's now one-dimensional region of fluid rather than two-dimensional. You go back to the other way, it goes back slowly to the rather nice circle boundary. So that's Safman-Taylor, and we had Philip Safman here again last week. He did this work with Taylor in the 1950s, and it's a nice, a very easy and nice demonstration. Lastly, though, to come back to the disc, because I forgot to show you how one can measure. I'll just run it once more. Actually, bring it closer in here. And you see that if I reflect a laser onto the screen, it will settle down to an ellipse. And the ellipse, the major and minor axes of the ellipse are related geometrically to the angle alpha, obviously. And so as you watch the ellipse decreasing in dimensions, you're watching the angle alpha going to zero. So obviously one can put this onto a video, record it, a video, and analyze the angle alpha as a function of time very accurately, and hence deduce the behavior as a function of time. So now it's almost an ellipse. It's accurately an ellipse when it becomes small. Oops. So you can watch it going to zero. I'll raise it a little. Oh dear, I missed it at the... I wasn't watching, I was watching the wrong place. Why? It's probably to do with the surface. I've got this stuff on the surface, and it's the way it reflects off it. But I find that it does it better with that than without. Off plain steel, this doesn't work at all. It needs this. This is somehow, it's some kind of like a diffraction grating that is on here. and it works very well. But anyway, that is how, in Cambridge, we also measured the alpha as a function of time, but then Vladimirov is that sort of person, he visits me, and he more or less took over from me on the experimental side. Well, I think that is all I have to say on this one. Thank you. Little omega is big omega sine alpha, yes. Yes. Yes.
The other point is that last week we heard that John Bolzan talked about final dissipation. And there's a theory
it's a similar technique, yeah. That makes very good sense. I think whenever the dissipation is very weak, that it should be possible to do that. Yeah, and that's why in the context of fluid mechanics, there might be sometimes justification in trying to solve the Euler equations, and then having solved them, calculate the energy dissipation, and again, then draw conclusions. Oh yes, yes. Oh yes, yes. Yes, that's true. It can be a very singular limit. But I should say, of course, a lot of the interest in the finite time singularities does come from the fluid dynamical context, because this is one of the major unsolved problems in Navier-Stokes and Euler dynamics. Do the equations remain regular, smooth for all time, or do singularities, internal singularities, develop? It's the big unsolved problem right now. A lot of the numerical computations indicate the appearance of singularity, or movement towards a singularity, but always these computations break down before you get there. So that's another problem.
Have you explored how experimentally the edge treatment
is? The edge. Yes, it does. It does depend on that. For example, this is actually made with two edges, and one is more around slightly larger radius of curvature than the other, and it goes better on the larger radius of curvature. That's probably to get better rolling or something. I don't know. But it does depend on these things, which again makes one sure that the rolling does contribute in some way to the dissipation. What's going on at the point of rolling contact. But you see, the great problem there is that nobody can tell me what the value of that constant K is. In principle, that is determined by the physical properties of the two solids that are in contact. But I don't think there is any theory available that will tell us how to calculate it. I'm not sure. Smaller and smaller amplitude. I'm not sure, but it's a fairly sharp edge, that's true, and there may be some rather nasty effects of that kind. It's possible.
Then what value of the thickness of this creature?
I don't know. I haven't worked it out, and it's certainly not a difficult calculation. I think that's probably just about the limit. That's half an inch thick and 3 inches in diameter. No, it hasn't. No, that's because I've treated it as a disc, a very thin disc. But okay, so one should take the thickness, call it B, and work out. And it's just a little more complicated, but can be done. I think, yes, Bendick probably made about 100 discs of different radii, different thickness, different curvature of the edge, and then chose the one that rolled for longest. and gave the most dramatic effect. I think he'll probably admit that that's the way he did it. Now, so Bendick is credited with inventing this toy. It's funny to invent a disc, you know, it's like inventing the wheel. But there's a lot of work in just finding the optimum size and shape. At the very end. That last 100th of a second, I don't really know. I honestly do not know what goes on in the last fraction of a second, last when it goes whoomp like that. I mean, it pushes the air out somehow. But just how it does it, I don't know. That dimension, alpha, it was alpha A actually that I figure is a fraction of a millimeter. It's about 0.2 millimeter. Couldn't I roughen? Look under the disc. Yes, and just see, and perhaps.
Right, but you have a hundredth of a second.
Yeah, and that's the time scale. It's a hundredth of a second. Yeah, Marshall. Yeah.
And he treated the problem with two discs rotating relative to each other. And he treated two different, they're very close together.
Yeah.
And he treated two different cases, one where they were moving this way and one where they were slightly inclined.
Yes, that's right.
And he used lubrication theory.
Yes. You're right. This. Oh, yes.
Something to do with your problem. But
yes.
What I remember is that as this come closer to close,
yes, it is very important.
So that eventually, I noticed the density of the disc is involved in your point.
The mass, it's only the mass, well, the mass of the disc, yes, is involved.
I see the time.
Yes, yes, the mass comes in.
But eventually,
width
may be generated.
Well, it's true, the pressure force is large, but of course this one is precessing. GI had one plane and a disc at an angle, and it was a slight angle, and it was caused to rotate. It was. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. His disc really was rotating, whereas mine is precessing, which means each point of the disc is just actually going up and down. So they look similar, but in fact they're very different, these problems. But you're right. Oh, the pressures are large. Yes, they are. Yes. Yeah, well, but you see, if I could solve that Reynolds equation, I'm not as clever as GI, and so it actually easier. It was a steady flow. This is this precessing flow, which makes it just that much more difficult to solve the Reynolds equation. I can't do that. And if I could, that would give me the pressure distribution, and you could work out the additional torque, and work this thing out exactly. It would give the same answer, though, but it would just determine the constants, you know, they'd be 3.2 or whatever. All I can say... feedback to the disc. It's the pressure, yeah, ultimately it is the pressure force that applies the torque that modifies that changes the angle alpha. That's ultimately responsible. But you can calculate it, you can bypass this by doing it in terms of energy dissipation instead. Hmm? At the very end, no, that's true. In this last microsecond, things, one moves into a different phase. And that's certainly worth looking at now, I think.
It's almost as bears on the ultimate end of the universe if there's too much mass.
Yes.
Any predictions about that?
It's just a matter of time scale, Yuri.
Mm.